Hi, it's Caroline Stephen, financial journalist. A special guest today on Talking Trading is market wizard Anthony Saliba. Anthony has been an options trader for over 40 years. For his first 13 years, he was a market maker on the Chicago Board of Trade floor. By the time he was 30 years of age, he'd made between $8 to $9 million. He was the only options trader featured in Jack Swagger's Market Wizards. He's a multifaceted serial entrepreneur. He built the first trading options simulator and he's launched trader education companies which have taken him to exchanges all around the world for the past 25 years. He's also built entrepreneurial tech companies, of which some have had exit points of over $100 million. His latest share market book, Managing Expectations, was released in 2017. Today's interview is Anthony's early life as a trader, how he got started trading at the Chicago Board of Trade, and the defining moments in his trading career, as well as the way he executes options. Anthony was very easy to talk to, very personable, humble, and you would never have realized how wealthy he is. He was a delight to speak with, and I hope you enjoy Anthony Saliba as much as I did. First, let's hear Louise Bedford's wisdom in Mind Power on when exactly not to trade.
We talk a lot about entering the market and choosing your timing. But should there be times in your life when you should not trade, when you should not enter new positions? Well, let's talk about that now. If you are unwell, if you're going through some sort of separation or divorce, if you have a spouse or child who isn't well, or maybe there is another reason that's more akin to a catastrophe going on in your life, then you should seriously consider letting your automatic stops take you out of your current positions and not entering new positions. Anything less than a catastrophe, though, is not an excuse. You should still be doing your scans. You should be in the arena because the day you don't turn up is the day you miss a trade that doubles your account. Your job is to avoid catastrophic errors because over time, these will have as big an impact on your equity as catching winners. And if you're going to make a catastrophic error because you have some bias or some sort of decreased cognitive advantage, then you need to stop and think. If you start trading to escape your circumstances or for entertainment, you will increase your chance of making a horrible error. So if you are going through some horrible event in your life, seriously consider stopping entering new positions. Let your automatic stops look after what you've got going on, but do not enter new trades.
Market great, Anthony Saliba. Hello and welcome to Talking Trading.
Hi, Caroline.
It's Sydney, Australia, 1998. And you walk across the Australian Stock Exchange floor and you literally turn out the lights of floor trading in Australia forever. Anthony, why were you the one who turned out the lights?
Wow, that's right. And we just passed that 20-year anniversary in January. I remember it was like it was yesterday. I was involved in process of educating the traders and brokers on what it was like to transition from open outcry to electronic trading. I kind of served a dual purpose. I had a company that did training. I still have that company, International Trading Institute. We've changed the name, that taught people how to trade and did so both in open outcry and click trading, electronic trading. But I also had a company that sold software to help manage market makers and brokers' activities electronically. And I was partnered with OM, Options Market, which is now part of NASDAQ, and research and trade, which is ORC Systems. And our system was called ORC. I was invited down to Sydney by OM and also ASX. And it didn't look like it was really, this was in 1996 when they were planning it. And not only did they need systems and some training, they actually needed to set up the rules for market making electronically, because they were different than market making in an open outcry sense. So I worked hand in glove with the exchange, the market maker association, or the group of market makers that were active on the floor at the time, and the floor brokers. And we worked out a set of rules for responding to quote requests and installed our systems and worked very closely with the exchange. So as they phased, now to the answer to your question, as they phased the tranching of moving the guys and gals upstairs to do everything electronically, the last tranche was kind of a bittersweet, I'd been there for almost 2 years at the time, ceremony where they had balloons and everything. It was the last day of the exchange. And a head administrator, project manager, and I walked down to the floor and literally ushered the last group out, and I flipped the switch with Paul and turned out the lights. It was really, it was sad. It was an end of an era, and I'd gotten to know everybody really well, became very close friends with those people. In fact, they weren't clients, they were friends. And I'm still very close with a few of them today. It was an interesting time. So,
and you loved Australia.
Yeah, I loved Australia. I love Sydney. I got to Melbourne a couple times, but I really didn't get to travel around the country very much. I went to the Outback a couple times, but I just love Sydney and her wonderful citizens. I'm getting a little choked up. That was 20 years ago. Stop it.
I was in the Rocks the other night, actually, and I thought of you living here. It's a really fun part of Sydney.
Oh, it is. It was good. I was really lucky. I mean, when I first got to Sydney, running my own business, saving our shekels, so to speak, I rented somebody's spare room and it was nice. It was out in the suburbs a little bit. Then as soon as I got the lay of the land, I moved to the Rocks. We tested our software in our condo. We did everything on the fly. Built everything there, customized. It was really a good time. And I think they had a very successful transition, actually.
Okay. So let's get to your trading career and your trading journey, okay. AJ. All right. Let's go back to the beginning. And I know you've told this story hundreds of times, but you haven't told it to us, and we would love to hear it. How did you get your start trading?
Oh, it's a great you're right. It has been told. I actually, you know, I caddied for brokers as a kid, bean brokers, in the early 70s when beans were going crazy, soybeans. There was a saying, beans in the teens, and soybeans went from like $2 or $3 a bushel into the teens and made a lot of these brokers a lot of money. And as a kid, caddying for them, I spent more time with them than I did actually with my own father. But I didn't know what trading was, and I just knew that they traded the commodities. I spent 4 years at Indiana, and I got an accounting degree and hated accounting.
Because you weren't very good at maths at school, were you? You said you weren't.
It was a tough subject. It was a tough subject for me in at grade school and even, you know, in high school. You know, I failed calculus and had to retake that. Fact of the matter is, it was accounting isn't even math. It's just boring data collection, right? But I stuck to it, got my degree, and really knew I didn't want to be an accountant. There's an activity at Indiana University called the Little 500, and it's a series of events. And the main event is the big bike race that emulates, probably this weekend or next weekend, actually, and it emulates the Indy 500 race car. And along with that race, there was a pedal boat race where teams of girl and a boy, you know, student, were in these pontoon boats with paddles, and they would race other teams, and they needed and keep in mind, this is Indiana in April. The lake is literally 50 degrees, and they needed frogmen to go in and steady the boats and be at the finish line as judges. And I was a senior and I was done. So I volunteered, you know, to do that. And I'm in the water.
Which is freezing.
It was freezing. We had a little libation to help out. And one of the judges in the boat who was, I was also a member of the Student Foundation, student government. And one of our directors was a judge. And he looked down at me and he said, "So Saliba, you graduate in a couple of weeks. What are you going to do?" And I said, "I don't know. I was interviewing for sales. And I had a number of sales opportunities in front of me, but he knew I was an accounting major. And he said, "Did you ever think about being a stockbroker?" I said, "No, not really." And I knew he lived in Indianapolis. And he said, "Why don't you come to work for us as a stockbroker? I think you'd be great." And I was thinking, what exchange is in Indianapolis? I knew there was one in New York and there were some in Chicago. So I'm thinking I'd be on the phone saying, "Hello, New York, buy. Chicago, sell." You know, and I got there and I was an account rep, an account executive. Well, Caroline, you know, that was the summer of 77 and Jimmy Carter was president. We were in the middle of the malaise with super high inflation and super high interest rates, and a good day in the stock market, a good day, one of the best days, the volume would be like 11 million shares. We do that in the first heartbeat now. So that's how boring it was. And they had me selling economic development bonds to farmers. And here I am, 21 or 22 years old, driving around in my beat up old Ford Falcon that I had. And nobody wanted to buy economic development bonds from some rookie. So I asked the guys in the office, "Well, who makes all the money in this industry?" And they said, "The guys on the floor." And it struck me, those guys that I was caddying for 4, 5, 6 years earlier were those guys. Mm-hmm. So I went back to Chicago and contacted some of the people that I knew. And I basically, I clerked for 6 months. I figured everything out really quickly. The guy who hired me as a clerk had promised me I could trade for him, but it was obvious that that wasn't going to happen. And what I had done, Caroline, I had made one of my clients in Indianapolis a lot of money in options. So I studied options the summer, my last summer after senior year. I didn't really start work until August. And in those 3 months, I learned a lot about options. And I made one of my clients some money trading in and out of technical analysis. So they offered me a spot to work for them up on the floor, and I took the test. And it was $1,500, which is a lot of money to me, to take the test to get approved to be a floor member. But it only had a six-month life. The guys that promised me the job ended up, you know, not being exactly what I wanted. So I went to work for this other guy I knew as a clerk who promised me a job as a trader. But as time was running out on my license approval, once that window closed, I was going to be indentured because I didn't have another $1,500 to sit and take the test. I bumped into one of those guys I caddied for. And he said, "Do you know what you're doing down here?" And I said, "I do." And he goes, "Why don't you show me?" So I put on a couple spreads in his account while I was a clerk, made a lot of money in a very short period of time. I took them off for him, and he said, "Well, let's be partners." And that was in 1978, and I became his partner for I had one thing I wanted from him. I wanted to be 50-50 partners, and that was so important to me. And he said, "No problem, no problem." I ran his $50,000 after almost losing it all up to about $500,000. And then I said, "You know, I don't know if I really want to be partners anymore." And he said, "Why not?" And I said, "Well, just think I'd rather do it my on my own, so I'd like to buy you out. And he goes, well, we all have partners. We all have the IRS. So I went a couple more years with them. I actually ended up trading for him for a little over 3 years. Then I went on my own, and I managed an account for him. I did well for him. But I started hiring my clerks, right? When I hired my clerks, I told them, if you're a good clerk, I will teach you how to trade and put you on a seat.
I know it's a long time ago, so we are going back a bit. What drew you to options?
Well, that guy in the boat who said, why don't you come up and interview? This is just kismet, if you will. His boss interviewed me, and he was, you know, I'm not a very big guy, and this guy's a big, imposing man. And I started at $800 a month. Okay, that's how much they paid me, $800 a month. He threw the OCC prospectus at me and said, here, read this and learn options. We need an options guy. Now, if anybody knows anything about the OCC prospectus, it's nothing but disclaimers and legalese. It has nothing to do with the biz. I read this thing over and over and over. I spent my last 3 months down at school, just sort of having my last vacation, getting ready for life, you know, working, reading the OCC prospectus. And then I found out that there were strategies. And I just took to it. I studied. I did my homework all the time. And one thing I did then and I still do now is I do a lot of homework. I try to be as prepared as possible. I started understanding strategies. That's how I made my client a lot of money, because I would leg into vertical spreads, for instance, and just in a matter of a few months, he was able to make a lot of money with very little risk. So I was kind of forced into it, Caroline. I guess the thing about that guy, and the reason why I mentioned how big he was, when I decided I was moving back to Chicago, I went in to tell him that I was going to quit, and he totally crushed me and said, you're never going to make it. He said, you're too small. It's a big person's game. All those guys in there are football players and basketball players so they can be seen and get noticed. You're just a little guy. You're never going to make it. And I was so mad at him. I was so upset that he wanted to dismiss my chances like that. I even, you know, emboldened myself even, you know, more so to prove him wrong. But, you know, in a way, he gave me a chance. In a way, he made me do options. But then when it all said and was said and done, and I was leaving him with, you know, less than a year under my belt, he turned on me, and I never saw him since. And I don't even know if he's still with us. But that was that was kind of another one of those defining times in your life when you'll never forget it.
So there's a couple of places I want to go here. You mentioned that you lost nearly all the $50,000, the original capital. And I know this is a big story in Market Wizards. Can we delve into it a little bit and how it made you feel at the time?
Sure. Well, there's lots of self-help books and introspective studies on what makes you better and what makes us stronger. And in fact, you know, over the years, I did things with Mark Douglas, rest in peace, in terms of discipline and understanding oneself. But I will say that it's better to lose, or if you're going to make money and lose money, it's better to lose first, you know, fail quickly and get it over with and learn from that. Well, the gentleman who hired me as a clerk and promised me that he would give me a spot trading did teach me some things, and we're still friends, and he still jokes. He taught me everything he knows. And then he reminds everybody, I taught him everything I know, not everything he knows. And I pretty much learned all I could from Steve and then moved on. But I thought I knew everything. I mean, Steve was really good, and we were doing some cutting-edge things back in 78. So when I got in the crowd on my own money, I just said, I'm going to do everything I did clerking for Steve, and this is going to work out just fine. Well, volatility collapsed in that first month of my trading, and the positions that I had on were positions everybody in the crowd had on. And when volatility collapsed, everybody was trying to get out, and my account went from, I had built it up to about 70,000 in the first week or so, and I thought, boy, am I doing great here.
And you were very young at the time. You were 22?
I just had turned 23, yeah. So I was 23, which I felt was, you know, pretty old at the time. It was the oldest I had ever been. And so I thought I knew everything, and I was leaning on this position. It literally collapsed on me, and I lost about 60 grand. It went from 75,000 to 15,000 in just a matter of a few days. And my partner was a guy I caddied for, but he really didn't know much about options. He had a different business. He just kind of got upset and said, listen, if you go get to 10 grand, we're pulling the plug, because I don't want to risk any more than the 50,000 I put in. So I was very nervous. And if you read Market Wizards, there was a plane crash that Friday where everybody on the plane died. And I felt that bad. I felt that low that I would have traded places with anybody on that plane at the time. I did a lot of soul searching. What happened, Caroline, is that we used to have a members lounge on the original floor. As a very active, intense trader, I never went up there. Mostly the older guys were up there. I went up that next Monday and sought out a couple of older guys that were standing in a less active crowd. Boeing, it barely moved. Boeing's price was up, you know, would move maybe an eighth, a quarter, 3/8, and back down. Whereas Teledyne, where I was trading, was moving, you know, $5-$10 a day, and just really was a bucking bronco. And I asked them, I said, look, I only have 15,000 left in my account, and I need to make this work, or, you know, I'm going to go bartend. And actually, I had gone to see a friend of mine from high school that was running a brand new, really popular bar in Water Tower Place called Hillary's. And I went to see him, and he said, I'd love to have you here. You could be an assistant manager. That gave me enough confidence to say, okay, I got a backup. Talk to these two guys. They said, Tony, what we do every day is we try to make a set amount of money, a very small amount of money. So what do you need to live on? And at the time, I had to pay my partner for his seat lease, which was $1,000 a month. And I had probably about $1,000 a month of other expenses total, both in the business and my personal life. So they said, okay, $100 a day, make like $400 a day, and sometimes a lot more, but that's my goal, one of the guys said. I said, well, would you mind if I came and traded in your crowd? Now, I didn't have to ask people at the time, but nobody wanted somebody horning in on their trade, right? In the crowd is just another mouth to feed. And they said, well, if you follow what we do and don't disrupt the crowd, which was a small crowd, maybe four or five guys, and there was maybe 20 or 25 in Teledyne where I was trading, they said, we'll let you do it. So I went in there, and it was like therapy.
Yeah.
Because Teledyne was screaming up 5 or 10 points, coming crashing down 20 points. And here was little Boeing trading between 40 and 45 forever. It would go, you know, a big day, it would go up a point. You know, mostly it was a half a point. But the markets were wide enough, and the spreads were, you know, strict enough in terms of a calendar spread. If you if you legged into a calendar spread, you were pretty much guaranteed to make that money. And sure enough, I was able to make $200 or $300 or $400 a day. Well, I had a remnant of a position left on in Teledyne that I was kind of watching out of the corner of my eye. Teledyne had an announcement and the stock started to run. And I said to the guys, I said, I'll be right back. I think I can get out of my position now. Rather than giving it to a floor broker to go take it off, I went back in the crowd. Now, I'd been away for 3 months and same guys were there. And all of a sudden, I had different outlook on what I was about to do. I went in there just to take off that position, but I had a discipline that I had learned from these guys and had practiced every day for like 60 days. And before you knew it, I took the position off and I said, you know what, I'm going to stand here for another minute. And the guy, when I came back in Teledyne, they said, what are you doing back in here? And I said, I'm just taking a position off. What's your position? We'll take it off for you. So no, I'll get out. I get out of the position. And then they said, what are you still doing in here? I said, well, there was a lot of paper coming in. It was a lot of trade. So I said, well, I might just trade the rest of the day. And I made like $2,000 in the second half of the day. The next morning, I went over to Boeing and I said, hey, guys, I got another position on. I'm just going to trade for a little while in Teledyne. And I never came back. And the guys in Teledyne were so mad. They're like, you're getting in the way, kid. But I was faster than everybody else. I went from one lot. That's all I was trading in there. And I did one lots for like 6 months, 5 or 6 months. And it aggravated the other big traders in the crowd because the floor broker would come in and I would be first on the market, half their quarters, you know, and then they'd say, HAS. And I'd said, one. And the floor broker was aggravated. I got 50. Can't you take them? I'm like, nope, just taking one. And I go, now I got to remember who was second. And and so I aggravated a lot. I don't think I told many people that story, but I aggravated a lot of people for about 6 months.
You were ripped a lot for it, weren't you?
I got a nickname, One Lot. They nicknamed me the big guy in the crowd, Larry Dubin. He derided me, called me One Lot. Now, my partner, Julian Good, who passed away last year at 93, he was a tough guy, and he didn't know much about options. And he told me, you know, he was the guy that said, well, we all have partners, you know. And what he did do that I'll never forget and give him total credit, he saw the account go up, you know, like steadily and somewhat astronomically over the course of that summer, you know, $200, $300, $400 a day, every single day. And then boom, in the fall, a couple thousand here, a couple thousand there. Before you know it, you knew it. It was, the account was well over 100 grand. It doubled his money. He called me up and he said, you're doing amazing. How are you doing? And I just told him pretty much what I just told you, because he lived down in Florida. And his advice, Caroline, that was really, really good. So there's two pieces of advice in this long-winded story. And that is, first, you can learn from your failure. And the first loss is the most important loss, as long as you can learn from it and recover from it. The second lesson is what Julian told me was, you know, be like a banker who has successfully been doing small loans and increase your loan size. So you're trading these one lots. Why don't you go to two? I said, okay, if it doesn't work, I can always blame him. And I did. And then I went from two to five to 10 to take it all. And I became like the biggest trader, definitely in that crowd. And I think I was probably the most active trader on the floor for quite a few years, where, you know, I just traded everything. I just never said no. I think that really rocky beginning shook my false confidence, you know, sort of burnished my real confidence into being something that I, you know, I knew my limits. And but one thing is I did my homework every night. We had a, this was before we had computers on the floor, long before we had computers, we had a mainframe, and you would, you had a little keyboard with a heat sensitive printer, or a printer that printed on heat sensitive paper, and a phone that went into a coupler, and you would dial the mainframe and you would log into the mainframe and get all of the theoretical values. You would set up tables and arrays of the stocks that you were interested in looking at, and it would print out arrays of theoretical values for stock prices moving up and down, for volatility moving up and down, for time and interest rate. So you had basically had a block of, you know, cube pricing, and I'd print all that out, and then I would calculate those spreads I learned in Boeing, and I would know the range, the worst case scenario on this calendar, best case scenario on the calendar, and on and on. So I did all my trading, what we called back then and still is true today, relative pricing. So I made all my markets off of other markets that were in the crowd. I never looked at theoretical values when I was in the crowd. I studied them at night just to know the relationships, and then that those relationships were fairly rock solid. They were rock solid for the day. They may have made adjustments overnight. That's what allowed me to make all the markets in the S&P 500 index after the crash, because all the computers broke down and I was the only guy. They waited for me every morning to come in, and well, not that I was late, but just at the bell, they said, okay, Tony, you want to open all the, you know, all the markets. And I, SPX had, you know, 100 strikes in each month, 6 months, and I would zip through those. It would take a half an hour, and I was the guy that opened the market every day for the end of October, all November, and most of December until volatilities calmed down and the computers were working again.
So that was one of your best trading periods, wasn't it? The 87 crash. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, some of that was positioning. It's kind of karma. We traded, we were actively trading a strategy called a box. And anybody who trades options knows what that is. It was an interest rate play at the time. Interest rates were still in double digits. And some of the shops, some of the big Wall Street firms like Merrill Lynch and Goldman and Morgan Stanley would come down and ask for a quote on a box, because you could, SPX was European, so you could buy a box and not fear getting assigned. And if you bought it for enough of a discount to parity, the full, let's say it was a $100 box and you bought it for, you know, 98, those 2 points, they would calculate an interest rate out of that. And they would come in, and that was a surrogate for treasuries. In the summer of 87, when the market was rallying, because it rallied into August and early September, we listed the 330 calls. So we asked for the 230 strike so we could have a 100-point box. So there was more capital. They could trade a bigger chunk of capital with less actual options. So they keep their expenses down, their fees, brokerage, and clearing down, and get a bigger surrogate to the treasury. So those 230 puts were worthless because the index was around 300. Companies would, like Goldman and Merrill, would come in and sell those to us. Now, in selling the box, we were long those, and they were just selling more and more and more, just naked short. We were buying them for a 16th, just because we made markets. You know, we were a teeny and eighth. And they would come in and they would sell thousands at a pop. You know, I had a bunch of them, and I had other positions on too, but when the market cracked, it went below that strike. And those teenies went $60. Mm-hmm. So you could buy it for $6.25, and they went to $6,000. They went up a thousandfold. Anyway, so I made most of my money during that period of time making those markets, trading, you know, wide spreads. I was always an advocate of trading the order flow. Whatever the customer order flow was, then trade against customer order flow, adjust the vols and adjust the prices as such.
Tell us about your butterfly spreads, because you're a butterfly catcher.
Yes. Well, right after I learned to go to something more than a one lot, I started, you know, my appetite was such that I wanted to find out what else was available, you know, in terms of interesting spreads. There was a rumor on the floor that there were two guys that were trading these things called butterflies, and nobody knew what they were. And one guy was kind of crazy, Nate Resnick, and the other one was very close to his vest, Richie Tobin. He was also pretty unapproachable. I said, heck with that, I'm going to approach him. I talked to him about what he was doing and picked his brain enough to figure it out, or at least understand what the strategy was, and started, and I went back to my mainframe and started running all of the what ifs, how does the butterfly breathe with all of these movements. And I positioned, it was the safest position because market could go to hell or could go to the moon, and that butterfly was never going to go beyond zero. So I did everything I could to inventory cheap or free butterflies, and by, you know, trading these volatile stocks. So I traded Teledyne through 85, did that for about 6 years. Then I traded currencies, were very volatile for about a year and a half down on the Cboe floor. And then when they relaunched the S&P 500, which was a cash settlement and wasn't getting any trade, they relaunched it as a European style. I was one of about four or five market makers that went in the crowd to try to re-energize it and relaunch it. And that's where my home was for the last 5 years I was down on the floor. And so all of those products were big movers and volatile. And I'd trade into the butterflies, and if they went to zero, okay, they went to zero. The real key to my trading was breaking down my position. I would start with the least risky spreads and just take them out of position and put them in a spread hopper. And I wrote my first program in 84 to do that. And I did it in DOS with one of the guys from the mainframe. You know, I would call every night and get those values. So in the morning, I would just take my position, zip it up, take all the riskiest things out, then the next riskiest thing. So I'd have buckets of risk. Least risky, don't even worry about them. Butterflies, forget about them. And then the residuals were the most risky, and you tended to those things because that can make or lose you the most money. And then occasionally butterflies would come back in and start breathing, and then you could start trading them from a different point of view much more profitably. And it was like playing a a xylophone. You know, you go up the scale and down the scale. And I was an athlete, you know, all my life, and I just would get into these rhythms. And that's kind of like what it was.
And that is all from Anthony the Great on today's episode. Stay tuned next week to hear part two of his interview and his life as a serial entrepreneur. I'm Caroline Stephen. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to talkingtrading.com.au with Caroline Stephen. Make sure you are subscribed to this website to receive the very latest market views, commentary, and expert opinion. Tune in next week as we've got a bumper show planned. Bye for now.
The views represented on Talking Trading are general in nature and do not take into account your objectives, financial situation or needs. Before acting on any of the information, consider its appropriateness in regard to your own situation.